Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland. Welcome to Rational in Portland. I'm your host, Kristen. Today, I have Lance Orton here in the studio from City Team. Lance was recommended to me by a friend who works in homelessness services. And Lance, we were just talking off air. I didn't even know that City Team existed until she mentioned it to me. This was not long ago, a month ago or something.
Yeah, it's been a quiet little nonprofit for since 1998 in Portland. And until recently, we were really, really siloed. So this is an exciting time for City Team Portland because we're finally connected to the continuum of care, which I'm excited to talk about.
Please. And tell us what City Team is and what the mission is.
Got it. So City Team is a faith-based organization based in San Jose, California, been around since 1957. It was originally very much like a rescue mission, right? You had your homeless shelter, you had a meal for the homeless, and it was a rescue mission. And then somewhere along the San Jose into Silicon Valley days, when the tech boom happened and people were moving into San Jose, the City Team, it was the San Jose Rescue Mission, had a building in right downtown San Jose. And the city came to them and said, you know, we would love to have you guys move. They didn't want a rescue mission in the heart of their new shiny tech city. So they architected a really great deal where they bought the building for a lot of money and then donated a couple of additional buildings. And so they moved to a different part of San Jose that was more appropriate for that kind of work. But through that acquisition, they had a ton of extra money. And so they decided, this was, tech boom. So 90s, early 90s in the 90s area. And they said, well, why don't we take all this money and go around the country and see where can we look at other rescue missions that are maybe in financial trouble and inject that capital and either revitalize them or shut them down. City Team Portland in 1998 was Peniel Mission. So again, very much a rescue mission on Grand Avenue, same building that we're currently at, 526 Southeast Grand in the Central East Side. And so in 1998, City Team...
Are you right by Multnomah County?
Are just down five or six blocks.
Wow,
so
yeah,
we're Grand Stark Hotel, Next
sure.
Adventure.
Exactly. Oh, I know. Yeah, I know exactly. Where. Yep. Are you across the street?
We're across
from
the street.
The hotel.
Yeah, my father's place. We've been across the street from my father's place, that iconic restaurant in the Central East Side since 98.
Okay.
And so, City Team came in. Didn't buy, but sort of took over the Peniel Mission and turned it into City Team Portland. And it was in the very beginning, still a homeless shelter, a rescue mission. And then they had a recovery program upstairs. So people coming into the mission that struggled with substance use disorder, addiction, they could move upstairs, stay in the recovery program for about a year, get their life turned around, and then back out into society. So forever, that was pretty much all it was. 2018, I came along. I was homeless in Portland. I showed up living in my car. I was addicted to heroin.
You showed up in Portland or at the mission?
Eventually the mission, but came to Portland from Bend via, long story there, we don't have time to go into it, but I basically came up from San Francisco. I was also raised in the tech world. My dad was a Silicon Valley CEO, founded a company that was the first website that you could buy an airline ticket ever.
Wow.
Founded that company with his buddies. It was called PreviewTravel.com.
That's amazing.
Later, through IPO and acquisition, it's now called Travelocity.com.
Yeah. Wow. Holy
and
cow.
So, yeah, crazy to even hear myself say that, looking back to my high school and college days.
Powered genetics.
Right. And that's what I thought I'd be, a Silicon Valley CEO, just like my dad.
Yeah.
And I was following in his footsteps, went to college, got a business degree.
Where did you go to college?
San Diego State.
Beautiful place.
Loved it. Great business school. A lot of partying. and then in 2005, after my dad had left Travelocity, he put together the merger. He retired at 50 with, stock options galore, bought an 80-acre ranch in Napa Valley, all Silicon Valley CEOs do.
I think it's in Austin, but yes, then it was there.
True. That's true. And then 2005, he was killed in a tragic accident. Total fluke. He was on a tractor on one of our properties, flipped on him, killed him instantly. And I, at the time, just was not spiritually equipped or mentally equipped to process the loss of my hero.
It would be hard to be, even if you had those resources.
Yeah, it was really hard. And so I turned to drugs and alcohol. And I, at some point in my dealings,
is this your 20s?
Yeah, it was my 20s. I mean, honestly, it started probably in my, you know, 18-ish. But I remember I got a prescription for Vicodin. And this is such a common opioid addict story.
Yeah.
You know, loved them. I could be functioning. They numbed all the pain and the loss of my father. And back then, it was pre-opioid epidemic. So prescriptions were like the easiest thing in the world. I had one through Kaiser. And basically, by the time I was towards the end, they were prescribing me 180 10 milligram Norcos every single month. And they would ship them to me anywhere I was, California, Oregon, didn't matter. All I had to do was dial in the press 1 for a refill, enter prescription number.
Isn't that crazy? Is Norco a form of Valium?
No, it's a hydrocodone. So it's it's Vicodin. Yeah, it's 10 milligrams. And as long as I had those, I was relatively high functioning.
Hydrocodone, you know? Is Vicodin?
Yeah, it is.
So those are the same things.
Not quite as strong as oxycodone, sure. But close enough. I mean, for me, and it wasn't.
You were getting this per month?
Every month, 180 pills. So
how many pills is that a day?
That's one pill every 4 hours, 24 hours a day.
Oh, my God. And it was just a never ending. It was sort of like it'll stop when you want it to.
And I didn't want it to. I had no reason to. I honestly didn't know how addictive they were. I mean.
Well, weren't they? I mean, at the was that during the Sackler marketing?
It was right pre the Sackler marketing.
Okay.
And then when the Sackler family started, you know, pushing, I never was prescribed OxyContin because my Norcos were so great for me. Like, I didn't need anything more than that.
Yeah, you didn't need to step it up.
Because I didn't want to be a drug addict. I wanted to be a high-powered Silicon Valley executive,
who just felt better.
Didn't want to think about the loss of my dad. And so that went on for years. Then the opioid epidemic became headlines. Doctors stopped prescribing. At this point, I was living in Bend, Oregon, doing the ski bum life, working in the restaurant business, kind of taking a break from everything. And I went through the opioid withdrawals for the first time when my doctors were like, nope, we're not prescribing. You're fine.
What year was this?
This would have been 2018.
That's what happened with my sister. Like, it was the same kind of thing. We were talking about this a little bit off air, a prescription from a doctor. And then suddenly it's, you're not getting this anymore.
Yep.
But it sounds like you didn't have an off ramp either. Yep. There was no assistance.
It was cold turkey and it was terrible. I was working at the Pine Tavern and I remember showing up one day and I was sweating. I was shaking. And there was this dishwasher kid.
And you'd never gone through withdrawals before.
Not like that. I mean, I had known if I didn't take my next dose in time, I would start to feel it, or like when I was waiting for my prescription to get filled.
Okay.
But it was always so consistent that it was never more than like a few hours that I was out. So day 2 or 3, I'm like going through all the withdrawals. I mean, for anyone who has been through it, they know. But if you haven't, I mean, there is no worse pain. I mean, I would have rather had my arm cut off than feel the pain of this withdrawal. So I tried to show up to work. There was a dishwasher who was also an opioid addict, and he saw me walk in the door, and he was like, I know what's wrong with you. Handed me a little bag of heroin.
Wow.
That was 2018, the first time I had ever seen but touched heroin. And I knew this was bad. Like, I knew this was going to be the end of me, but I was so.
That's not that long ago, Lance.
No, it's not. Less than 7 years ago. That's
amazing.
My sobriety date is October 1st, 2018.
That's also very quick.
Yeah, it's been
So what month of 2018 do you get the heroin?
So this was 6 months prior to October 1st. So sometime in the spring.
Wow.
I was, I tried it. It worked. I mean, it got me well. I knew from the beginning this was going to be bad stuff. Within 6 months of using heroin, it went from smoking to shooting.
Yeah.
I swore I would never do that. And then I did that. And then I was like, well, at least I don't shoot it in my neck. I'll never do that. The last time I ever touched a substance was a shot of heroin in my neck. And that led me to homelessness, all the things that go
in
along.
Bend. Were you in still Bend. In Bend?
Yeah. So I'll tell the quick, crazy Cameron story because it's important. In Bend, there was a drug dealer. Well, he wasn't a drug dealer. He was the guy when you didn't pay your drug dealer, he would show up to make sure you paid. And we called him Crazy Cameron. And this guy was like a scary ex-con, you know, arms the size of both of my legs, which I know that's not saying much, but they were pretty big.
No, it's scary.
Yeah. And so I needed to get away from this guy because I had no criminal experience. You know, when you had my Vicodin prescription, I didn't have to associate with the drug dealing world or the criminal world because my dealer was Kaiser.
Right. And so, you're the Travelocity kid from San Diego State. You know, you just want to live in a beautiful place and ski and like, how did I get here?
That's exactly. I remember the day I said that and it's coming up. Crazy Cameron, he was shaking me down all over Bend. He would find me and he'd shake me down for everything I had. And then he would turn me loose. And this went on for a few months. Finally, I was like, I've got to get away from this guy. I packed up my 99 Jeep Cherokee. I had $50, half a tank of gas, big old ball of heroin, and I drove to Portland. I'm going to get sober. I'm going to use this up. I'm going to live in my car. I'm going to get sober. And now I'm going to turn my life around again. And so I'm in the Walmart parking lot in Troutdale. That's where I made it before I ran out of gas. Went through the heroin. I started going into detox. White knuckled it in the back of that Jeep for 5 days. Holy it crap. Was absolutely terrible. I remember
in the back of a Jeep,
in the back of my 99 Cherokee. And I remember day five, I just couldn't hack it. I just was like, I can't do this. I was praying to a God I didn't even know, like, just take me or give me some reason to live.
I mean, in Troutdale, I'm actually kind of shocked that somebody with selling drugs didn't knock on your Jeep and say, hey, you've been here for a few days. Anybody in here, you want some of this?
Well, you have to remember this was 2018. So this was before there was a whole bunch of homeless camps in that parking lot. I went and visited it recently and it's a lot different.
Wow.
I kind of was able to hide there because it's a 24-hour Walmart.
Right, that's right. And you can, you know, the whole thing is if you've got an RV or you need to spend the night, you can get your supplies and everything there and bed down there in the parking lot. Yeah. I mean, not literally on the pavement, but in your vehicle or your RV or whatever.
Yeah. So day five, I'm like, okay, I can't do this. Like, I need one more fix. And so I got on my phone and I found a girl in Bend that I knew I could trick her into bringing me some dope.
Okay.
Turns out somehow, and I don't know how this happened, but Crazy Cameron found me through that conversation. I come out of the Walmart bathroom as I had been for days.
Holy cow.
And he's in the back of my Jeep with a gun hiding under all my clothes. And he says, get in and drive. I'm taking your Jeep and everything you own because you pissed me off and you owe me some money. And so I'm driving and I'm terrified. I mean, I'm like withdrawing. I think I'm going to die or worse. He's going to beat me into a pulp and leave me on the side of the road. And as I'm driving, he starts rambling he was high as a kite on meth, really scary guy. And he starts rambling about Jesus in the desert for 40 days. Which meant absolutely nothing to me at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that was just foreign language. And then he says, don't worry, Lance, I'm not going to hurt you. God told me not this one. He has a plan for you. You need to go to rehab and get your life together. In the moment, this did not register as anything other than the ramblings of a meth addict, and I needed to get away from this guy as quickly as possible, right?
Long but story. Now that's your God moment, probably. That I mean, I know that's spoken as a religious person. Spoiler alert, I am a religious person, but.
Well, I am now. I wasn't prior to that. That was my aha moment, but I didn't realize it till about 90 days later.
I mean, it literally was the ramblings of a meth addict, so it's fair to assume that's what it was. Yeah,
and the story gets crazy. I actually reconnected with him recently, and he actually was a believer at some point, but he had relapsed, and in his relapse is when I met him. Crazy story.
Wow.
So anyway,
how did you reconnect?
I'll tell you. I'll get there.
Oh my gosh.
I know we don't have that much time.
I'm literally on the edge of my seat here. I just look downwards and I am.
So he doesn't hurt me. He gives me a shot of heroin in the neck, takes pity on me because he knew I was dope sick. And then he drove off into the sunset. And so I'm standing somewhere in Portland. I have no idea to this day where. And I remember that was my aha moment. I just looked and it was almost comical. I'm like, this is a rock bottom that I'm not willing to go below. Now everything, my wallet, ID, phone, car, clothes, everything. I'm just standing here with this shirt on my back. And after that brief moment of like, okay, I'm done. I had some kind of full-blown panic attack. I don't know. Someone found me unconscious, called an ambulance.
Whoa.
Woke up in Kaiser, ironically, in Sunnyside.
Yeah.
And they kept me for about 4 days. And finally, a social worker came in and was like, you don't want to leave, do you? And I was like, I don't have anywhere to go. I'm homeless for the first time at 43 years old.
Crap.
She gave me a voucher to the City Team Portland homeless shelter. That's how I got to City.
So was that Clackamas County then?
Sunnyside, Kaiser. I don't know if that's Clackamas or Multnomah. I think it's still Multnomah.
It's just right on the edge, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So I get the voucher. I go to the City Team shelter. I'm waiting in line. I go through the shelter process. After a couple of days, you know, I start noticing.
So at this point, I'm sorry, just to back up for a second. You're in the hospital. And you had already detoxed, or you were in the process of doing that?
They had, guess what? They were giving me a little bit of Vicodin while I was in the hospital.
Oh,
so
sure.
I was, you know, manipulating them to do that because I was so terrified of going through withdrawals. But I was slowly starting. It didn't really start until I got to the shelter at City Team.
Okay. And they, what, triaged you basically?
So at City Team, we're not a medical facility. We're a shelter. So if someone comes in and they need detox, we will certainly send you to Hooper or one of the detox facilities. But here's the thing about opioids. You don't need detox, despite what people may say.
Yeah. It's not like alcohol.
It's not like
alcohol. Because you're not going to die. It feels like you're going to die.
It feels like you're going to die. But at that point, I just cold turkey kicked it for 5 days. I mean, I was so desperate at that point. I didn't want to go back to that life ever again. I never wanted to deal with crazy Cameron.
I'm assuming you had support at City Team and they were giving you what advice about this is what it's going to be like.
Yep.
This is what it's going to feel like, but you're just going to hang here. You're going to be fine.
Yep. Well, they told me, they were like, if you want to stay here for a year for free, we'll help you with your disease. We'll help you get sober. We'll teach you about this God guy. And I was like, live there for free for a year. Where do I sign? And I signed up and I just went through that whole process. But here's the crazy Cameron kicker. 90 days in, I'm thinking about crazy Cameron. My head's cleared up now. Now I'm sober. Mm. And I started thinking, that guy really did me wrong, right? Like he stole my Jeep. I want my Jeep back when I get out of this place. Total insanity. This is the the addict mind. It takes a while to heal.
Buy it back. Yeah. I'll just find him and shake his hand and buy it back.
My thinking was, you know, now I've got the whole weight of the legal system and the law enforcement behind me. Like I'm coming after this guy. I know. Sure. Total insane. So I knew that I could find him on Facebook because that's how he found me. So I jump on Facebook and on the little messenger, I see his name. Mm-hmm. It's like green light. You know, I was like, oh, I got him. And right as I was about to start writing this ridiculous plan that I was coming after him, it hit me like a brick what he said in the Jeep 90 days earlier. Don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you. God told
me. That's crazy that didn't come back to you until then.
It is very strange. But again, I was detoxing from heroin, which takes a while. And so
how long does that take?
It was 30 days of pure hell for me. But then post-acute withdrawal syndrome can take up to 18 months.
Yeah.
And so for me at 90 days, I was feeling pretty good. But boy, that was my aha moment. That's when I realized God was real. He really was there. Whether he used crazy Cameron to let me know I was going to be okay, or, you know, to let me know that he had been pursuing me my whole life. And so I wrote back to crazy Cameron. I'm like, hey, thank you for what you did. I'm in a Christian treatment center. Keep my Jeep. It's yours. Bye. And then I deleted him and all the other unsavory contacts on my Facebook page. So that's how I got there. And crazy Cameron came back in just like 3 months ago. He reached out to me, found me on Facebook, and he was like, hey, is this the Lance that I stole your Jeep? I want to make amends.
So he's in recovery.
He went to prison right after he stole my Jeep.
Wow.
Had a come to God moment in prison, got sober. His little girl apparently reached out to him and was like, Daddy, how come I never get to see you? So he's been sober now 6.5 years, which I'm coming up on 7. And
close.
Yeah. Pretty wild.
It's totally wild. What is the faith that City Team is based on?
It's a Christian program.
Just general Christian.
Yep. Just non-denominational.
Non-denominational. Okay. So it's not any specific church.
No.
It's not literally no affiliation. Just
We partner with Bridgetown Church, Imago Dei, Grace Chapel, a whole bunch of churches that pour into our programs, which is incredible, which is my first experience with any church in my life.
Okay.
Like, it was the most unlikely place for me.
Well, from San Francisco, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I went to Catholic school, but it didn't stick.
Well, and yeah, that's so, I mean, I'm Catholic, new Catholic, but it's not user-friendly.
Good. Well said.
It's just, it's really not. There's a big barrier to entry there. And it's, I mean, in my opinion, that's part of why it's dying and part of why non-denominational Christianity, especially evangelical Christianity, is growing, because there's such a, it's just so accessible.
Yeah. It's relatable.
It's relatable. Yeah. And the people look like, you know, they're not wearing collars and went to a seminary or so. I mean, they just look like you and me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, this is a really incredible story, Lance. So City Team has existed for a while. I don't know why it's suddenly on my radar, but it sounds like it's has this unique time of growth currently from what we talked about off air.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened was, when I was in the program, of course, having a business degree and thinking that way, I'm like really into, how does this thing work? How's it funded? You know, what is your annual budget? And I would like bug the executive director to death, and he would just kind of shrug me off, like, go back to your classes. And then when I graduated, I got into homeless services through another organization that hosted Night Strike under the Burnside Bridge on Thursdays. It's like a homeless outreach community that's been going on in Portland for 21 years. So I started, that was my first entry, but I stayed connected to City Team, and I realized that it, City Team didn't have any development. They weren't plugged into the ecosystem. They were very siloed. And so finally in 2022, the current executive director reached out to me, and he was like, hey, I'm moving to Omaha.
Wow.
Like, I'm out of here. I think you're the next guy to take this thing over.
Wow. What a compliment. Run it.
Yeah. But I was like, no way.
So at that point you were sober how long?
It would have been 2022. So 4 years-ish. Something like that.
And your thought was no.
Yeah. I was like, I don't want to lead a Christian organization in Portland. Are you kidding me?
Well, it is. It seems like it would be a rough gig.
I've barely been a Christian for like 4 years, right? Like, I don't, what do I know?
Yeah. But also, like you said, you know, I'd never been affiliated with a church before. And I was thinking, yeah, of course, San Francisco. But that's the whole, Northern California through all the way up to the Canadian border. That's, I probably the most unchurched place in the United States, don't you think? I mean, Portland probably compete for that slot.
Yeah. There's an incredible faith community in Portland that I've noticed.
I agree. It's small. It's very small.
It's small, but it's growing, and it's not growing because of the church. It's growing particularly because Gen Z is really open to spirituality.
That's interesting.
It's not like that. It's not because of the messaging or salvation. It's because, and I just read this fascinating article. It was like, for Gen Z, they don't care if Christianity is true. They care if it works.
Huh.
And I can relate to that. That was my profound moment. Like, I don't need to know if the Bible stories are true. It's working in my life in a way that my life is, you know, better than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And it's because I've surrendered to God. He's driving, not me.
So obviously, at some point, you said yes to this
request. I did.
That's your current title, right?
I did. Executive director. And what happened was, is they told me they were going to shut it down. So here's the real moment. Mm. Like, I look at City Team as my alma mater. It was there the day that I needed help and I was ready to surrender. They let me in that day. No questions asked. I had warrants for my arrest. I had zero money. I had no insurance. And so to get into treatment, like, I called. I remember I actually called from the hospital to try to get into Hooper, and I called a few programs, and they were all like, well, you need $10,000 or this insurance. And I was like, this is not going to work. And so when I got to City Team, I didn't even know there was a treatment program there. I just knew it was a shelter.
Wow.
when I found out the recovery program was there. Anyways, they were going to shut it down because our building in the Central East Side is dilapidated. It's obviously the need is so great. Our programs are really full, but it needed a seismic upgrade and a new roof and plumbing. And so the previous director was like, you're going to have to figure this out or we're going to shut it down. And so I took that as like, wow, my alma mater can't shut down. Like City Team is so important for the people that need help that day when they're ready. They can be in a program the same day. Like we have to keep that pathway to recovery.
What a monumental task you took on.
It has been so much fun. I mean, it was just one of those right time. I was in the right place, ambitious, you know, here I am a 43-year-old ready to prove myself. Right. So
we obviously believed in it and it sounds like it saved your life.
Yeah.
So you had this motivating factor to keep it, felt probably some loyalty in that you owed this institution something.
Exactly. Yep. And I just didn't want it to shut down. So, and it was just, again, the right time. Like I had made enough connections in the political landscape. I had made enough connections to peers in, you know, Dr. Andy Mendenhall at Central City Concern is a, you know, quiet mentor of mine. I mean, there are people out there doing really incredible things. And I just wanted City Team to be part of that for the first time. And so through collaboration, we were able to buy a brand new building in Old Town. We have this 30,000 square foot office building that we're converting into a residential recovery program.
Wow.
Yeah, super exciting. 120 beds of housing for people in recovery.
That's amazing.
Pretty exciting.
I mean, so give us a sense of what the services are like. I mean, I know it's bleak, but what are the services like currently in Multnomah County? Like how many detoxes are there? There's Hooper, there's Fora Health, and one other?
Yeah. I mean, I know there's some private ones, Pacific Crest detox. We primarily use Hooper. That's when we need to send people because of alcohol detox. We send them to Hooper. There's definitely not enough detox sobering center. You know, we've got the new sobering center opening if the county ever gets it together. I just read now it's going to be more money and two more years and all that. But Julia Brim Edwards has been a champion of that. And I have a lot of respect for her getting it to where it is. We need more recovery programs. I mean, we need, and not treatment program. I'm not talking about medical 30-day spin cycles where people come in and get some counseling and get on MAT. We need community-based recovery programs where people can stay for 6 months, 8 months, a year even, because it takes a while. I mean, there was an article about Fora's beds being empty at their treatment center recently. And the reason is because people don't want to go into treatment if they have for 30 days, if they have nowhere else to go right after treatment. So programs like City Team that create long-term residential programs are so vital. Blanche House has one, Union Gospel Mission, Portland Rescue Mission. These are like really needed right now.
Yeah, what they need to hear is exactly what you heard, right?
Yeah. And they're also the one thing not funded by the county and SHS dollars, which is mind-boggling.
Why? Because it's faith-based?
I don't know the honest answer. I've never heard that it's because we're faith-based. We tried.
Is Hooper funded?
I don't.
By the county?
I would think so. I don't know that.
I don't either. I mean, I know what they do fund.
Yeah.
You know, needles and tents and things. I mean, I know what they do fund. I do know that for a fact. I've seen that in the budget, you know, but.
Yeah.
I mean, and Julia said in budget meetings, I'd like to see more of a focus on an off-ramp, like on recovery. Mm-hmm. And what the health department says is, well, we're focused on harm reduction, which is focused on the reduction of disease, not recovery,
which is not a model for success. I mean, that's like putting the band-aid on or getting the treatment started. Like it took for me, it was at least 2 years before I was ready to stand on my own feet. And I had a college degree and, you know, with a lot of advantages that most people in recovery don't have. So it just takes time. It takes a community.
So tell me about this model that City Team does, which sounds like it works. I mean, do we have data? Obviously, we have your story, which is extremely powerful. I'm assuming there's data saying this is what works. This model works because it sounds like it's wraparound services as long as somebody needs it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can give you our data. What we know is that of the 41 graduates from our program on the men's side last year, we have going back 12 months, 76% are still sober, still thriving with a living wage job. That's another key thing. To graduate our program, you have to have a job. Like, we're not going to graduate you if you don't have a job, because what is the point of that? You're going to walk out. You don't have any money for rent. You're not. That's just, to me, bonkers. Like, we should be helping people get trained in workforce development and help you get a job. So by the time you leave our program, you're actually ready to be self-sufficient into some kind of housing. And maybe it's permanent supportive housing, you know, maybe it's on a voucher, but our goal is to get you self-sufficient.
My mind is being blown as I sit across from you that, this seems like the kind of program that people would want to do nothing but fund. My mind is really blown by the fact that it exists and the fact that it's not trumpeted more by officials. Is there anybody that you know in government currently who backs City Team or wants to see it funded? I mean, Julia probably does.
She does. Sharon Myron was a big champion of it. Yeah, I'm sure Sharon would be. I mean, our mayor, Keith Wilson, like, they're all, like, really good. They're fans of it.
And you're on the board of Shelter Portland with our mayor.
I am.
Which is, I think that's significant.
Yep, it is. It's a shift for sure. I mean, Mayor Wilson has opened the door to the faith providers that have been working on homelessness and addiction for a millennia in our county. So that's a big deal. And I don't know, you know, the funding, I don't know the exact reason why we're not funded. Like, we've tried and we've been told no 4 times. There was many stories in the media when I went out and told that story.
City and county?
We have never, city doesn't really fund.
I know, but like Dan Ryan did those safe rest villages.
Yes.
And he did an end run around the county and was, I mean, not now, because now the county is in charge of running it, unfortunately. But at the time when he was doing it, their success rates, when he was in charge of the Housing Bureau, their success rates were quite good for transitioning people out and getting people the services, that figuring out what they need and getting them connected to that.
And that's kind of what Housing First, we always hear about this Housing First thing. Housing First is great if it is actually Housing
First.
What
does that mean? Does that mean like the safe rest villages, or does that, because in Portland, what people seem to mean when they say Housing First is an actual freestanding unit in a building somewhere, as opposed to a safe rest village where if you're there, you know, you've got to connect to the services, where there's some kind of quid pro quo going on.
It's supposed to mean in cities where it works, it's if you can put someone in a stable and secure housing environment and then provide all the wraparound services that they need to overcome whatever challenges that cause them to be homeless. And in Portland, addiction is way more part of the problem than people in the narrative are willing to admit.
What is the data that you have on that? Who is, I guess, for lack of a better term, street homeless? You know, because homelessness means all sorts of things, right? I could be couch surfing and be considered homeless because I technically don't have a place and I'm staying at my friend's house or with relatives, maybe even.
Right.
But if you're like the people we see in tents on the streets, for instance, which I think is what most of Portland seems concerned with, rightly so.
Right.
What is the data on street homelessness and causes?
I can only tell you my own data and what I have experienced. I'll tell you what I've not seen. I have never met someone in our shelters or people that we serve through outreach on the street who became homeless and is living in a tent because they ran out of money or they couldn't afford their housing. People don't become homeless in tents when they run out of money. They become homeless when they run out of relationships.
Right. That's my experience with family members too.
And that's
you run through your network.
Exactly. And you burn the bridges.
Yeah, you destroy it.
And it's not until those people put up tough boundaries, like my mother did, and said, nope, you're not getting any more money. No, you're not staying on my couch anymore. Had my mom, when I was living in the back of my Jeep before Crazy Cameron came along, given me one more motel room, one more couch stay, I never would have made it to City Team.
Yeah.
She said, no, don't call me until you have a year of sobriety. And that was when I was like, oh, shit, I better start figuring this out.
Wow.
So I think some of that accountability is another thing that we lack here in Multnomah County. And I love countering the statement that, oh, we can't arrest our way out of this addiction problem. True, but I will tell you this, 75% of the 50 beds in our recovery program are guys that are court mandated to be in treatment. And they will tell you, every one of them will tell you, best thing that ever happened to them, because they never would have been able to see the carrot of recovery without the stick of going to jail first.
I mean, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Not that we want that. Obviously, the criminal justice system is a blunt instrument, but when you've burn through your network and you need money.
Yeah. It's not the best way to do it, but for the people on the streets, the people that we, the visual side of homelessness in Portland, what we see every day that pisses people off, the people in your doorway, the people vandalizing my building, the people breaking into my cars, that section of homelessness, if we were to focus on that and we did use law enforcement, Multnomah County used to have, I think, 5 treatment ready dorms that people would go in and they actually would detox you in jail. I couldn't tell you exactly. I just had a great conversation with Nicole Busher.
Oh, I love Nicole.
Yeah, Nicole's fantastic.
She's been on the show, the head of the corrections union.
Exactly. And she told me
Multnomah County sheriffs
that Multnomah County Jail used to be a really great way to detox people, get them connected to services.
That's true. She did say that. She would like to get that back. She would like to use those 250 beds that we're not using.
Yes.
That are cordoned off, doing nothing as a way to get an off ramp to get off of.
And then organizations like City Team and Blanche House and Portland Rescue Mission, we can come and grab those people when they're released and put them into programs.
Yeah, as opposed to just dumping them on the street and handing them a tent.
Our women's program, City Team has a women and kids program in St. John's, 24 beds, small little program. Wow. But our the women that come into our programs are being released from Coffee Creek.
Okay.
So what happens is when they get released, a lot of those women
it's the women's prison.
Yep. They don't have anywhere to go.
Yeah.
And so we are there. We scoop them up. We've actually started building relationships with them while they're in prison.
Okay. That's
and then
great.
The day they're released, boom, they come to us. They've already got community. They can stay with us for a year, whatever it takes to get them ready.
It's amazing.
Yep.
That's amazing. So tell us, what do we need to change here in Portland to see more of this work? Like, actually, let's start with, can you tell me a little bit about housing? Because you provided me a statistic, and I don't want to forget this. You provided me a statistic when we were offline about housing in the Pacific Northwest area that just blew my mind.
Yeah, so I really struggle with this narrative, which is the common narrative. A lack of affordable housing is driving our homelessness in Portland. When I heard that over and over and over, I decided to start doing some research, because something didn't feel right about that. And I know there's data, you know, John Tapagna at Eco Northwest, they've got data in cities, and this is him speaking, in cities where housing is really expensive and there's not enough affordable housing built, you see higher rates of homelessness. I believe that that's true. My question is, when me and a couple of my developer friends started to look at, okay, well, let's see how many affordable 60% MFI houses.
What is MFI?
Medium family income. So affordable housing for people who make less than 60% of the median family income. SROs.
What is that number? Do you know?
Oh my gosh. I think it's 80 in Portland. I think it's 82%. So 82,000.
What, like a family of four?
So this would be 60% MFI just means their family income. So a single person or a family.
Sure. Okay.
You have to make less than 60% of around 80 something thousand.
Okay.
So I wanted to look at, okay, so how many current, so first what happened, I went and visited some affordable housing buildings that had just opened and some that had been open. All of them had 100 units plus total. And then when I went inside, I asked their vacancy rate. Every single one of them was 50% empty. And so then I started thinking, wait a minute, if in 2 weeks I could go visit 4 buildings that had 50% of 100 units, that's 200 empty units. I wonder how many empty, vacant, ready-to-go units in the Northwest region, in the Tri-County region.
And these are all private buildings. Like, there's no bureaucracy preventing people from getting in there.
These are Home First. These are the Brio apartments, Home Forward, you know, all the affordable housing developers that we have here in Portland. So I went and asked, I didn't ask, I did an AI search along with a developer friend. I said, find out how many empty, vacant, ready to rent units for 60% median family income or less, 8,000 plus empty, vacant units in the Tri-County area right now. 8,000. If there are 8,000 empty affordable housing units, then you can't tell me that a lack of affordable housing is driving homelessness. You could put every single unsheltered person and then some in those houses, and we would still have some left over.
I've never heard this before.
So, I mean, I've been fact-checking myself on this for a while.
Because it is so crazy sounding. Because all we, like you said, all we hear about is that we're in a, this is, that homelessness is a housing crisis, an issue that centers around a housing crisis.
Now, don't get me wrong. We do need more housing because the units that are available and empty, maybe the answer is they're not affordable. Like, that's a piece of the puzzle that I haven't quite figured out. Of those buildings, like a one bedroom that's considered affordable is around $1,000 each. And I can tell you that, you know, my graduates coming out of the program, if they were to spend $1,000 a month on their rent, that would be 60% of their total income, which is not a good
recipe. That's not a good financial model.
Yeah. So I'm going to meet with John.
But you're saying that there are SROs available that your graduate, that you have placed graduates into.
Yeah. There's an SRO downtown, $675 a month, all utilities paid. Like, that's great. That's that we're filling those right now with our graduates. But the key is that.
But the graduate, I know they're employed, but they're making, I think you said on average, $22
an hour. $22 an hour.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, this isn't, they're not, you know, salaried working for the city or something. This is like real entry level stuff. Right. These are newly sober people, right? Right.
They've been in our program for usually on average about a year. So they've got a little bit of savings.
They're ready to transition out.
They've stabilized. Yeah. And that's the key too. Like, the Housing First model, if you really, you could consider the people in our programs as part of the housing, you know, they are housed while they're with us for that year.
True.
If we had taken them from the shelter, like when I had come into the shelter and they were like, hey, we've got a unit for you, a one bedroom unit, here's a voucher, and put me in, I would have been a heroin addict.
Yeah, that's how people die.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have lasted a month.
End up dying indoors. We're setting it on fire or what, and a lot of those places can't get insurance now, is my understanding.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding?
Sure. Yes. It's really challenging.
It's really challenging. Right. So sure. I mean, I suppose if the definition of Housing First program is something like City Team, then it's just, that's never what I've understood it to be. I mean, what I've understood it to be, I guess, from Portland politicians is what you just described. It's a voucher for a room.
Right.
Probably not indefinitely.
And the way they, like Jessie Burke, I was meeting with her the other day.
The Society Hotel.
Yep. She pointed across the street and she said, there's a building right there that's considered a Housing First building. I can't remember the name. They have one staff member downstairs at the lobby. And that's, they put people in that building that are coming right off the streets or right out of whatever. And then that's, and consider that the wraparound services. Like, that's not the wraparound services.
This is from the county?
To keep people. I don't know how it's funded or who it is.
Well, it sounds like.
But that's not Housing First. Like, that's just putting people in a building and hoping that they don't burn the place down.
As Dan Ryan would say, I guess, leaving them where they're at, essentially. Like you said, the only difference, it's sort of, I guess it would be like your mom saying you can live in the basement.
Right. I would have died in the basement.
So how does fentanyl change all this? Was fentanyl involved in the drugs that you were consuming in 2018?
No, that's a good question. That is one area where I will admit there are, maybe there's some things that I don't have direct experience and understand. Fentanyl was just coming onto the scene right when I got sober. Wow. So it has changed the game. I detoxed from heroin cold turkey on that shelter floor for 30 days. I have heard from Dr. Andy Mendenhall that fentanyl is a lot different than heroin. And so the reason that we see these harm reduction, mm-hmm. the medical assisted treatments, Suboxone, Sublocade, those kind of drugs, I was so grateful that I didn't use those drugs because I'm not hooked on them now. I'm completely free. Mm-hmm. But I understand that fentanyl is a lot harder to detox from. So I'm doing some research on that, I hold on to that painful detox experience. And that's what keeps me ever from going back to that. And I wonder if I had been given drugs to ease me off slowly, if that might not have been, you know, I would be less apt to go back because, oh, if I relapse, well, at least I'll just go into a detox and they'll give me drugs to ease me off of it, right? Like, yeah. You see what I'm saying?
I do. If you're seeing people coming through City Team, though, whose substance use involves something other than alcohol, I'm assuming, and if it's a street drug, not prescribed, which mostly it is now, because like you said, the days of 180 pills from Kaiser or whatever are over,
right?
Then it must have, I mean, they must be tangling with fentanyl because according to PPB, it's in everything. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing it doesn't touch in Portland.
Correct. Fentanyl and meth are the two biggest drugs that we see in our treatment centers
today.
But
your treatment center continues to have this level of success, the 70-some percent level.
Yeah.
And it hasn't dropped despite the fentanyl.
The lowest surge I've seen it drop is if you go 3 years back, which is right when I started.
Okay.
It's 72% of our graduates are still sober, housed, thriving, living wage job. 72%.
That's the lowest.
That's the lowest percentage it goes.
So in the last couple years of, well, or it would probably be the year after that, and maybe what 2 years out from that, the data is better. There's more, the success rate's higher.
I would think so.
And that's post fentanyl.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's the lowest, it has to be higher.
Yeah. Well, addiction is, it's a loneliness disease. I mean, it thrives in loneliness when you're isolated.
I mean, this is hopeful.
I agree.
This is good news, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, it's a dark subject and topic, but if that's the case, if, you know, you're not, and obviously you would know. I mean, it's a small enough set of subjects, right? So if you're looking around, you see nothing but beds, it's what's happening here, you know, then you would just know, okay, this isn't working. We got to come up with some other model.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what the exciting piece now that I'm seeing for the first time is there is a huge effort to collaborate all the different partners right now. So MHAAO, City Team, Union Gospel Mission, join, all these organizations are coming together to share resources for the first time. And wow. We're like meeting.
How did that happen?
I don't know exactly who started it, but MHAAO has been hosting a pilot outreach program every other Thursday out of a building in Old Town.
What is MHAAO?
Mental Health Addiction Association of Oregon.
Okay.
We say MAO. Okay. I'm probably butchering that. Janie, if you're listening, I'm sorry. It is. Janie Gullickson, a good friend of mine, is the executive director, lived experience across the board. All the outreach workers, case managers, peer support, they all have lived experience doing incredible work. And they have started to connect with us, those of us that have treatment beds and residential recovery programs. Great. And we are heading out in Old Town on the streets. Right now, it's only every other week. But we're getting ready to launch something even bigger in collaboration with the coalition of the faith-based providers and other Old Town providers, where we're going to be heading out every day. Every day, 7 a.m., we're going to start going out, connecting people to the services they need. At the very least, I'll tell a quick story.
Please.
When our new building in Old Town, it's on Northwest 4th and Davis. Over Christmas, it was empty. We just bought it. We hadn't started construction. I would show up there to get some work done, and there was somebody camped in our doorway every morning, like 3 weeks. He had his tarps pinned up in the door wedges. He was writing on graffiti on the trash everywhere. And I remember every day I'd have to like, oh, dude, you got to go. Like, I'm going to call the cops. Get out of my building, right? And I was getting a little frosty around the edges because it was pissing me off. This is our brand new building.
I guess it surprises me, Lance, that you didn't say, hey, I work for...
Well,
this recovery team, can I help you?
Here's what happened. After about 3 weeks, I realized, okay, I got down on one knee and I was like, hey, what is your name? And instantly, instead of yelling at me or, you know, he said, Josh. And I was like, Josh, I'm a heroin addict. I came into the City Team shelter with this voucher. Can I give you a voucher to our shelter? And he was very calm. He said, what would that look like?
Wow.
I explained it to him. I wrote the voucher. He quietly packed up all his stuff, cleaned up his trash on the sidewalk. I never saw him again. I don't know that he went into the shelter or not, but the point of the story is just that learning somebody's name and getting down on their level and asking, hey, what do you need?
Yeah.
Changed the whole dynamic. So I'm thinking, what if we did that every day and every doorway? Let's start in Old Town because it's a very easy geographical ground zero place to focus on. And it's not just City Team, but it's Portland Rescue Mission, Blanchet House, it's Join, it's MHAAO. We're all going out organized 7 a.m., learning who the people are on our streets, collecting data, connecting them to services. And then when Mayor Wilson and the police start to enforce the no camping ban, which they're going to have to do at some point.
Why do you think they'll have to?
Because if they don't, people are going to continue to get pissed off. And downtown is never going to come back if we just allow people to camp on the streets, right?
I mean, your mouth to Mayor Wilson's ears.
Right, exactly. And he knows that, you know, he's not going to, you know, he just on KGW, he kind of backtalked his, you know, we're not going to arrest people. But that doesn't mean they're not going to enforce the camping ban. So what if outreach, we're going out, we're humanizing the problem, we're learning who these people are, we're getting them connected to services. Then servant-resistant individuals, the ones who want no help, they're going to have to be moved along. Maybe we send them home, as Mayor Wilson's always saying.
I don't think that's a terrible idea.
I don't either. But we have to do it. It's going to have to be a collaboration.
It is. That's right. Yep. That's exactly right. And it sounds like people are coming together.
Yeah. And not just the nonprofits. This is going to take the business exactly community. Right. Like I was just at We Believe Portland on Friday at Providence Park. Amazing. 1,800 people coming together to clean up our city. Right. And then going out and spending money in a restaurant. What a brilliant, simple idea. And my friend Ryan Buchanan, you know, he's always like, you know, hey, what can we do? What can the business community do? And so we sat down and we started talking about this outreach thing. And I'm like, what if we plugged the business community in once a week? You and your business, your team at your office come down and volunteer with a trained outreach worker at 7 a.m., humanize the problem. They get to get involved. It will destigmatize the issue. I hope it will destigmatize the issue. And those of us that are already doing it every day, we're getting a little support because we need help.
For sure. What is it like doing this? Because, I mean, I worked downtown since 2004 until last July, really. And it's dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, I was attacked outside my building. Like there's some dangerous things going on. And according to like outreach workers like yourself that I've talked to, and maybe you agree with this, it's getting more dangerous. Like it's just the substances are getting more concentrated, more serious, more powerful. And if they're not killing people, they're harming them in a significant way, at least for the period of time that they're on that substance, whatever it currently is. And it seems like it's morphing every 2 seconds.
Yeah.
So what is that? Can you tell us at all what that's like? I mean, there must be variables. My guess is not everybody responds when you ask them to.
Correct.
For their name. And you probably have to use a fair amount of awareness when you're doing this and be aware of your surroundings.
You're kind of getting into the civil commitment discussion that needs to be had and is being had.
It does need to be had.
I just ran into Sharon Myron down at the state capitol last month.
She's brilliant on this topic.
She's championing it. There's
former Multnomah County Commissioner Sharon Myron.
Yep. Scott Kerman at Blanchet House. He's championing it. Like we cannot allow people on the streets who are unable to come into a program or a shelter because they're so out of it and they're hurting themselves. They're hurting others. They're creating property damage. They're ripping stop signs. I saw this guy the other day ripping a stop sign out of the wall.
That just sounds common. That sounds like something we see every day here.
And that's not arresting. That's taking care of our population. That's committing them into a facility or an institution or somewhere until they're either ready. Because my prediction, I'm going to throw some wild numbers. Please. My prediction is 75% of those people, as soon as they detox from the meth and the fentanyl and the drugs, will become more willing and able to go into a program, right? But we have to get them there. And that's where, like, we can't arrest our way out of the problem. Then don't call it arrest. Call it, we're going to take care of you until...
Well, we used to call... Obama called it drug court.
Right. Yeah, drug court's brilliant.
We used to call it...
We used to call it
drug or mental health court.
75% of our residents
when we funded that,
from drug court. Yeah. And there's the people in it are so grateful that they got arrested.
That's my understanding from the, and I think Nathan's trying to, of course, what he's learned from Multnomah County is that his budget's getting cut by 5%.
I can't believe they're cutting parole and probation. It's bonkers to me.
Parole and probation. I mean, I want that to sink in for everybody. You know, because that's stuff like what they call close street supervision.
Yeah.
Which, as Nicole Buescher, who you know from Corrections, says, it doesn't even work super well. Yeah. Not anymore. I mean, it's just helpful for paperwork. It's just helpful for if somebody's a violent individual, we can get them off the streets faster. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of paper trail there. But if that's gone... Yeah. I mean, everybody's just running around.
We should be putting more money into county corrections, Multnomah County jails. We should be funding those 250 beds to get people ready for treatment.
It just seems obvious.
Yeah. And D.A. Vasquez, I believe that he's the right guy for right now. But boy, is he facing some real struggles with that budget. And I just hope that they can somehow get creative and find the money they need to expand, because they're going to need it.
Well, they won't if it's cut by 5%, because at the safety summit that I was going to see you at, it sounds like last week that I moderated with the DA and Nathan Vasquez in Multnomah County, and it was going to be Chief Day. Of course, he was in an event that you were at that ran right up to that. Yeah, District 3 Town Hall. Aaron Schmautz, who's the Portland Police Association Police Union President, filled in. And when I asked Nathan about this, like, tell us about your budget, that was when I heard, oh, it's going to be cut by 5%. And he said, where will I, he was very specific. Number one, he said, well, where would I take money from? I mean, I'm going to have to take it from hopefully non-person to person crimes. And hopefully those are probably units that are successful, like the auto theft task force. That probably goes away. So property crime goes, you know, that will go unattended to in or at least in a lesser sense. And he also said, look, we're a DA's office, so we're not like a lab. You know, we don't buy chemicals or equipment, or it's not a hospital. It's people.
Right.
So people are cut. Right. You know, investigative services are cut. Or DAs are cut. That means if they do that, they do have to get rid of units and move people around. Because he said, what am I going to, and he grew up as in the DA's office as a child abuse DA. And so he used that as an example and said, well, what am I going to do? Cut from child abuse? Cut from homicide? And he was like, as it is, we only have, I mean, if I remember correctly, it was very few. I may have heard one dedicated homicide detective, which blew my mind, or at least investigator. So I guess the point is, if you're dealing with those kind of numbers already and it's getting cut, and there are specific programs that he said just won't be funded, like he runs the strategic prosecution unit. Mm-hmm. The only reason the defendant in my case is even currently being held is because of the strategic prosecution unit, which stationed more officers out and about on the streets of downtown. Mm-hmm. Nobody was around and I screamed, help me. Mm-hmm. Nobody came. Nobody was coming.
And it probably wouldn't have happened if there was a cop standing around.
Well, probably not. But fortunately, they were arresting people across the street at the library and they had an operation going on and they happened to not be in a car transporting and came running around and helped me. But without that, there wasn't, I mean, downtown, as you know, it's very sad. It's a ghost town. I mean, there was nobody around. It was 10 a.m. on a Tuesday in July. It was a beautiful day.
Yeah. It's getting better, though. I will say I have noticed it. The other day, I walked out of my building in Old Town, and there were tourists with their backpacks. There was two little old ladies with shopping bags in Old Town on a Tuesday morning, and I hadn't seen that in a while. That sounds amazing. And I'm a chronic optimist. I fully admit that.
Well, you have to be, because the only choice is, you can't live with the alternative. That's
right. No.
So nihilistic and so horrifically depressing and sad on every level and scary. Yeah.
And I'm not.
Why would we do that?
And I'm not going
to. And you're in the recovery business. Yeah. You've got this direct opportunity to affect things.
Yeah. And Portland's where I started living
in a really specific way. I mean, I think that's amazing. Yeah. But this strategic prosecution unit that Nathan helped start, I just think what they do is they keep track of this is this person's criminal history. We're going to pay attention to that and highlight it so that we can get them to connected. And he did this. I mean, get them connected to the services they need to be connected with. That happened. Also, keep them if they've got person-to-person crimes in their history, keep them away from the population until we know that there's some safe history there and it's okay. We can integrate. Yep. And then we want to integrate and see them do well. Like your programs, we want to see them employed. If they're doing well, we're all doing well.
Exactly.
I mean, that helps. Well said. Of course we want that. Of course we want that.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want that? Exactly. For everybody. Probably mostly for the defendants caught up in that system.
Yeah.
Because it's that or they're back out and there's fentanyl and they're dead. Yeah. I mean, we know that that's the end, right? Like, we know the end of this story. If there's no intervention, they will die.
Yep. It's only a matter of time. I mean, 450 something last year, right? I mean, that's only going to increase unless we increase the number of people interacting with and in providing intervention on the streets. And sometimes that means arrest.
It's sorry, Portland. Unacceptable. Those death rates, it's unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder how many of those could have been avoided if we had committed them ahead of whatever it was, when they died.
Tell me what is on the horizon there, because that would be a culture shift here in the Pacific Northwest pretty severely.
I don't know about the civil commitment. Personally, I haven't been deeply involved in it. I know that there are, like I had mentioned, there are people like Scott Kerman, Sharon Myron that are out there really advocating at the state level legislature.
That's amazing alone, that.
And if I had the time and bandwidth, I would be all over it, but I'm focusing on the addicts.
You have a full-time job and then some. Yeah.
Right. But I think that there is a shift coming, and I don't mean a political shift. We thought there was a political shift coming, and then the elections happened, and we saw Portland get more and more progressive. And I'm not a conservative by definition, but
people who live here aren't.
Right.
They wouldn't be, really.
But I was pretty shocked to see that we went even farther. But I think the shift, it's not political. The shift is in people that love Portland that aren't leaving, are committed to doing whatever it takes, and they're starting to come together. And I've seen this in my own groups and coalitions, Ryan Buchanan, the We Believe in Portland people. We're starting to see the business community, the ones that are invested and not going anywhere. They're like, what can we do? Like, I'm ready to get involved. And it doesn't matter what political background you come from. Like, this is about making our city.
I mean, the only reason I use that word is because historically it has.
Correct.
That's the only reason I use that word, because the Pacific Northwest is sort of the epicenter of refusing to engage in those kind of processes. I mean, you live elsewhere.
Right.
They have those systems. You know, Florida has it. They have systems in place that everybody works with to help people.
Yeah, help.
To give them an off-ramp.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's sort of amazing. This is all sort of amazing news, isn't it?
Yes, it's baby steps in the right direction.
Well, it sounds more than baby steps, the kinds of things that you've talked to me about just in the past hour. It sounds, I mean, the kinds of expansion that you're going through.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to, like, I wish we were shrinking and not expanding. I wish that I could work myself out of a job because
that's the goal, right?
I have no desire to be part of the homeless industrial complex that just perpetuates homelessness in our city. I want to be part of the solution. I want to see people like me who were lost, addicted, turn around, and actually be able to give back and be part of the solution. Because I think that we are the most powerful and effective people at solving this problem because we've been there and we know what it takes.
Lance Wharton, thank you so much, City Team. And where do people find you? Is there, can people get in touch with you, and what is the best way?
Yeah, absolutely. All you have to do is go to City Team's website. My face pops up. My story's the first thing you see. I have emails, phone calls. Like, I'm the easiest person to find in the world, and I would love to hear from you. So reach out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kristen.